Hello. On this week's program, we listen back to a 2008 interview with Frank McCourt. The acclaimed author died on Sunday, age 78. Jason Pfeiffer takes us to the Simeone Foundation Museum, home to a world-class collection of historic sports and race cars. Susan Lewis visits North Philadelphia's Village of Arts and Humanities, which evolved from the creation of arts parks on abandoned lots into a community-based arts program. And Tom Keels explores the cooperation between historic sites in the Germantown section of Philadelphia and the local school districts that is turning thousands of students into history hunters. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Born in New York City and raised in Limerick in southwestern Ireland, Frank McCourt came to attention in 1996 with the publication of Angela's Ashes, a memoir of his childhood in Ireland in the 1930s and 40s. The work details a very tough upbringing. His father, an alcoholic, left his family poor and destitute before finally completely abandoning his wife and four children. Frank McCourt quit school at 13 in order to work to feed his mother and his surviving three younger brothers. Three other children, twin brothers and a baby girl, died of disease and malnutrition. Angela's Ashes won the 1997 Pulitzer Prize for Biography or Autobiography and was made into an Oscar-nominated movie. He wrote two successful follow-ups, Tiz, about his life in New York City as a young man, and Teacher Man, about the 30 years he spent working in the New York public school system. Frank McCourt achieved success as a writer later in life. He was 66 when Angela's Ashes was published, and although he was at an age when most people retire when he was finally published, McCourt had throughout his life been obsessed with literature. Frank McCourt died in New York City on Sunday. I spoke with him last year when he was on a brief visit to Philadelphia.
A lot of the time, expatriate Irish people and Irish Americans or those of Irish extraction tend to have a very romantic view of the old country. You've always kept perspective and trumpeted both Ireland for its charms and faults.
Charms and culture. Music, poetry, the literature, the spoken word, all of that, and the sense of hospitality.
And have you over the years changed your view of your own identity as an Irish person and as a New Yorker, more to the point?
Well, I've been able to free myself a lot of stuff that I grew up with, because we were in school, I think it was a very unkind atmosphere, and we were always afraid. And then when I left Ireland at 19, I would go back from time to time, but I always went back with a chip on my shoulder. You know, I would see a priest that had been mean or a schoolmaster, and I wanted to knock them off their bicycle. But then that lasted a long time. But then I started writing about going to school and my family and the rest of it. And you want to blame somebody, but I would look at these priests and look at these schoolmasters and Edwards, and they were all men of their time. They were all victims the way we were. Although I think some of them knew what they were doing. Some of them had that kind of intellectual power. They knew what they were doing, and that's unforgivable.
But that went on many years after you had left. We've met many scandals in Ireland since then.
Oh, sure.
It's changed now.
It's changed. I don't know if the sickness, the sickness that's partly built into Catholic celibacy is still there. They're not changing that. But there's a greater sense of liberation. Now, when you go back to Limerick, for instance, you're going to meet, you walk up O'Connell Street, Limerick, you'll meet people from all over the world working there.
How do you think that's affected Ireland? We were once the great migrant race, now we have our own immigrants.
Now we're, well, you know, it's made Ireland more cosmopolitan. Last year I was walking up the street in Limerick near where I used to live, and on one side of the street there's a Polish pub, and on the other side there's an African grocery store, and out of the Polish pub comes Polish music, and on the other they're playing drums outside the African grocery store.
How do you feel as somebody who's been writing about your own life for better than 10 years now, when you set out in this endeavour, and you were a late bloomer,
oh, yeah.
How did you imagine it would be to have the world know your life, and what was the reality like?
I expected a mild reception or less than mild, maybe no reception at all. I thought I'd write this book, and I had no agent, no prospects of publishing. I thought, well, I'll write it. I'll show it to some friends of mine. Former students of mine were in the publishing business now, and I was trying to track them down. And I thought, well, maybe it would be nice to have it published. My dream was, you know, I'm so superficial. My dream was to go into a big bookstore like Barnes & Noble's when the book was on the shelves. It would come out. They'd put two or three copies on the biography section, and I'd watch people fingering it and looking at it. They're beautiful women. And that would give me enough satisfaction. I didn't expect to make any money or anything like that.
But out of this 60-something-year-old man came this wonderfully formed prose. Did you know it was any good as you were writing it? Did you know you were a good writer?
I thought at the end of it, when I look back, and I thought I'd buy it. I'd buy it myself. Because I thought I did the best I could. I found a voice. I found a style that I think is fairly unusual. Taught from the point of view of a child going from 4 to 19, which I realized later on is exactly what James Joyce did with Portrait of the Artist. Only his book is a little more sophisticated than mine. His book it ends in a crescendo of poetry, which I did not achieve.
Doesn't sell as well as yours.
over the years. It never hit the bestseller list the way. And a movie was made of it, which was a disaster. But still, that's a classic. That's what we refer to when we talk about classics in Irish literature.
Are you a New York writer or are you an Irish writer?
New York. I'm not Irish and I'm not Irish American. New York with Irish ingredients.
And an Irish accent.
An Irish accent, yeah. And I'm always aware of the Irish thing. The Irish, you know, I read the Irish Times a lot, and I'm constantly drawn to Irish literature. I can't get away from it. Not that I want to, or the music. I was always a friend of the Clancy Brothers in New York and the Chieftains, and that stuff just gets my toes tapping.
Could Frank McCourt have come out of a Limerick had he stayed there? Could Frank McCourt have come out of a Dublin? Is this of New York you're writing?
It's of New York because of what I experienced as a teacher. The 30 years in the classroom led directly to a room in New York where I started writing Angel's Ashes.
Final question. It's been all about your life. Any thoughts of making it up? Any thoughts of fiction?
Oh, yeah, that's what I want to do. Everybody wants to write a novel, and that's what I'm doing right now. That's what I'm struggling with. It shouldn't come as hard as it's coming, but I keep changing the focus and I keep changing the characters. But the thing is, I haven't spent enough time on it. I keep running to Philadelphia and in San Francisco, but I'm writing. I don't give a damn now. After May, I'm digging in, and I try to finish that. I throw away about 10,000 words recently, but I'll get back to it.
Any clues as to plot? Location?
Well, the location is Brooklyn in the 1980s, and it has to do with, it's autobiographical in a way, and it has to do with largely that neglected segment of the population called teachers and what they're really like, because you rarely come across them in fiction. Usually the people who write them don't know their ass from their elbow. That's what I want. I want to get into that.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
Frank McCourt, who died of cancer on Sunday in his native New York City. His final wishes were that there be no funeral services or memorials, saying, "Let them scatter my ashes over the Shannon and pollute the river." The novel in progress he spoke of in our conversation was, alas, never completed.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
While the car you drive to work or the mall may bear little resemblance to a souped-up, sleek machine that hurtles around a racetrack, its functional and aesthetic design likely owe a debt to the race car. Showcasing dozens of prize cars from one collector, the Simeone Foundation Museum in Philadelphia examines how competition inspired much innovation in the auto industry. And as WRTI's Jason Piper now reports, the museum also demonstrates the artistry involved to design and build these useful and at times very beautiful machines.
Whether or not you consider yourself a gearhead, cars have a way of stirring up emotions. Perhaps you fondly recall the simplicity of a car a parent owned, or become nostalgic over reminders of your own first set of wheels. While sentimental bonds to automobiles are common, Fred Simeone takes affection for cars to a whole other level. Over his lifetime, the retired neurosurgeon has gathered over 60 cars.
I guess the collection really started based on my relationship with my dad, who was also a general practitioner but worked his way through medical school fixing cars. So by the time I was 9, 10 years old, we were doing cars.
A Philadelphia native, Simeone says he and his father would spend hours poring over car magazines, going to races and visiting junkyards, finding vintage cars to fix up and tinker with together.
So I had a little bit of a head start in terms of knowing what's good and what had a potential to be great.
Beginning with 4 cars he inherited from his father, Simeone built the bulk of his automobile collection over 4 decades, acquiring Bentleys, Mercedes, BMWs, Alfa Romeos, Jaguars, and Ferraris, many of them bought or swapped for at a time when the cars were much easier and cheaper to obtain. At the outset, Simeone didn't have strict criteria for the kind of cars he collected, but he eventually came to recognize a common trait.
Winning competition cars was the theme of the collection, even though I didn't articulate it until later on. Great sports racing cars were not numerous when they were made, and nowadays there's a lot of people who want them. But in those days, I could not only get a competition car, but one that was a winner.
Today, few individual collectors can rival the scope and value of Simeone's car collection, which is in many ways, he says, the result of a lot of luck, similar to the fortunes of another Philadelphia collector, Dr. Albert Barnes of the Barnes Foundation.
Who got into French Impressionist painting a little bit ahead of the curve, and he was able to accumulate a collection which would be impossible to duplicate now.
The cars that Simeone has accumulated are today housed in a former engine manufacturing plant in South Philadelphia, forming the Simeone Foundation Museum. This nonprofit was created about a year ago as a way to keep Simeone's entire collection together for years to come, open to the public. About 2/3 of the cars are still in running condition. Once a month, the foundation holds a demonstration day, when 2 or 3 of the vintage machines are pushed out, started up, and driven around the back parking lot. Kevin Kelly is the Simeone Museum's curator, which in the car museum world means he's essentially in charge of maintaining the cars. When I visited, Kelly was preparing a 1913 Mercer raceabout with its wooden wheel rims, 2 bucket leather seats, and no side doors for a demonstration day. He offered to take me for a spin.
Just hop on the chair.
All right. Good.
That's the starter. That engaged slowly.
With numerous vehicles in the collection nearly a century old, Kelly keeps busy ensuring that the cars remain in working condition. Indeed, they don't always start right away, but he eventually got the Mercer running. The fact that a race car built in the early 1900s can still impressively speed around a paved track, adeptly handling tight corners, says something about the craftsmanship of these cars. It's one reason Kevin Kelly finds them so compelling.
This kind of stuff, this pre-war stuff, it's workmanship that's built into them. All nice materials, brass and aluminum and wood and leather and everything you can do with your hands and with your mind working together. That's what I find appealing about them. And I think if you talk to anybody that's fooling around with these old cars, they're going to have that same kind of feeling about them. That's the way they love them.
Inside the museum, cars are displayed to tell the stories of how the vehicles competed in their time. Enormous dioramas painted by Philadelphia muralists serve as backdrops, depicting the famous race courses and circuits where many of the cars actually competed. Watkins Glen in New York, Italy's Mille Miglia, the Bonneville Salt Flats, and France's Le Mans. Showcasing race cars built from 1909 to 1975, the exhibition demonstrates how car technology evolved in the 20th century, often spurred on by the desire to be more competitive in races. Cars became safer, sleeker, smoother, and more efficient. Tires went from being tall and skinny to short and wide. Aerodynamics progressed. Fuel injection was introduced, and brake technology drastically improved. One hallmark of the Simeone collection is that the vehicles closely resemble the production cars that an average consumer could have acquired. The Simeone Foundation's Harry Hurst describes them all as racing sports cars.
And by that I mean they're cars with headlights and fenders that could conceivably be driven on the road.
And so what we try to concentrate strictly on racing sports cars. We don't have Indianapolis cars, open wheel cars, Formula One cars, things like that, because those are so far removed from the production automobile that you or I would drive.
Hurst says this guiding principle means that the museum's main exhibition doesn't include cars built after the mid-1970s. After that, racing became so competitive and commercial that the cars no longer resembled any production models. For Fred Simeon, the appeal of racing cars prior to the 70s extends far beyond their use in competitions, horsepower, and engine size.
There is a pure artistic aspect to these cars.
Whether it's the 1909 American underslung car with its slender white tires, the fire engine red bullet shape of the 1938 Alfa Romeo, or the smooth silver fender lines of the 1953 Jaguar, it's clear that a great deal of creativity went into the design of the machines.
The best analogy that I can give you is furniture. We all know that furniture is a practical thing, but it's also beautiful. And it goes from Empire to Victorian to modern furniture, but in every instance, it's a utilitarian object made to be beautiful. Well, so is the automobile. And I think in many ways deserves the same respect that fine furniture does. We try to portray that.
Portraying the beauty, sophistication, and evolution of engineering that continues to capture the imagination of generations young and old. While the average person doesn't fully understand how an automobile works, they are compelling contraptions. And the Simeon Museum cars remind us that we're not always just interested in getting from point A to point B. Whether we're racing or going to the grocery store, we have a long history of wanting to travel in style.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. The Simeon Foundation Museum in South Philadelphia is open year-round, and today at noon we'll hold a demonstration day, giving visitors a chance to see select cars from the exhibition in motion. North Philadelphia was once a thriving combination of factories, working-class communities, and commercial corridors. Yet in the post-industrial age, residents of many neighborhoods cope with abandoned buildings, poverty, blight, and crime. Yet in a pocket of North Philadelphia is a village distinguished by its art parks, with glittering mosaic sculptures and colorful murals. What began as a single art project in 1986 has evolved into a multimedia community arts program that includes theater, dance, video, and spoken word that has altered the landscape and is changing lives. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis takes us to the Village of Arts and Humanities.
Interspersed among the row houses that hug small side streets, about a mile north of Temple University, a few blocks east of Broad, is art and art in the making. Even on a gray, blustery day, reds, yellows, and blues jump from totem pole sculptures covered with cut glass and ceramic. Colored pieces of tile shine up from the sidewalk, and life-size mosaic angels seem to watch us from the outside wall of a house down the street.
We have the after-school program right here, 2544, that's Germantown Avenue.
Leon Sanford is 17 years old.
And in the back we have, you know, the stage where, you know, when the weather breaks, we do a lot of outside stuff.
Art-filled spaces of all sizes abut the small row homes, seven of which house administrative staff, a media lab, a studio for tutoring, and an education program with dance workshops. Together, they make up the heart of the Village of Arts and Humanities, a place that strives to use the arts to change lives, with a focus on young people and the community. Young people like Leon Sanford, who's been with the village since he came on a summer work program over 3 years ago. He helped organize a hip-hop festival for the community in 2006, does video production in the after-school program, and also does TLC, which in the village means Teen Leadership Corp.
We're like the teens that everybody looks to when there needs to be a fundraiser or it needs to be, you know, something community-wise. They look to us to basically help plan it and help get everything organized for it.
The village began in 1986 with an unlikely pairing of personalities. African-American dancer, drummer, and educator Arthur Hall asked Chinese artist Lily Ye to help create a park from the empty lot next to his Ilei Ife Humanitarian Center at 2544 Germantown Avenue. Although she secured a $2,500 grant, Ye had never done this kind of work and had no idea what it would cost. What's more, the landscape architects and other experts she consulted predicted failure.
They all laughed. They say, you're Chinese, you go to that neighborhood. Kids going to destroy everything you build. And $2,500 is a drop in the bucket.
And yet?
It was really a little voice in me said that you have to rise to the occasion, otherwise the best of you will die and the rest amounts to nothing.
Determined to engage the community, Ye went back to Arthur Hall, who suggested she enlist Joseph, or Jojo, Williams, an unemployed man living in a half-abandoned place next to the property.
He heard there was this crazy Chinese woman on the street and looking for him. He said, well, I want to have nothing to do with this woman.
Ye went to the neighborhood searching for him anyway. Once, twice.
The third time he was tying his shoelaces. I said, Jojo, I got to talk to you. And then he was angry with everybody. Everybody was afraid of him. So I didn't go there to battle with him. You know, I went to him, I said, Jojo, I need your help. And that just changed everything.
Another neighborhood man, James Big Man Maxton, came on board. With buckets and water, paint, concrete, and shards of glass and ceramics, Lily Ye, Jojo, Big Man, and a crew of neighbors, many of them kids, created first the Ely F.A. Park, and then, as more lots opened up, another park and another. They created animals, birds, and guardian angels to watch over the community and honor the cultural traditions of everyone involved.
For example, the lions. The lion came from the Chinese tomb guardian lions. They are fierce, but of power and dignity. So Big Man, anything Big Man touch is African in looking, and his grew. So the Chinese guardian lion looks African. And that's really the Village of Arts and Humanities.
The Ely F.A. Humanitarian Center closed, but the village grew. Today there are 17 parks, 12 in the heart. Lily Ye, now retired from the Village of Arts and Humanities, is continuing her work around the globe in places like Rwanda and Beijing. The village, which has won awards and attracted international attention, no longer builds new parks. But the ones in the village heart create a welcoming place for village activities, says village teen Leon Sanford.
This place is like gravity. I mean, everything just flows to it. That's what I believe. So, like, when you get a chance, you know, just wander around. You'll see what I'm talking about.
Graphic designer Alan Jacobson did just that several years ago and found himself playing ball with a bunch of kids. Today, he's president of the board.
I felt sort of welcome in this neighborhood that I wouldn't have imagined would be that engaging. And as I walked around in the parks, there was just something about this place, something had definitely happened here that was meaningful.
And from the start, it was about more than the land.
Now, our first talked about drama is called There Is a Future, written by our own youth today. You know, that's a good thing. I must say it is something...
The village offers programs in dance, theater, and video production, and hosts community events like readings and video screenings. Community arts manager Al Sawyer says the neighborhood has embraced the village and vice versa.
Since I've been here, I've probably been to 20 or so court hearings, or I've probably escorted 15 students back to school who dropped out. I don't know if that's been part of my quote-unquote job title, but that's just basically, you know, the role you find yourself in, being in a community where there's 40%+ unemployment rate.
Over 20 years after its founding, there are still boarded-up buildings near the village, still evidence of poverty and blight. Yet success can be measured in other ways.
I think success in the village today is measured by how the teens are affected and how they are growing, not as much by the condition of the building next door.
I want to actually be an editor, you know, a video editor. Take an idea and, you know, run with it.
The fact that we're consistently here and they consistently... on top of everything else we're doing, we're still kind of still a beacon of hope.
The Village of Arts and Humanities doesn't have a post office or a general store or a conventional school, but it offers a sacred place of beauty where young people can come, connect with others, and tap into the creative power of their own lives.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Is the study of American history an endangered species? A survey of 500 college students has found that 65% failed a basic American history test. While almost all of the participants could identify popular celebrities, less than a quarter knew James Madison as the father of the Constitution. Now, WRTI's Tom Keels explores a local program that is bucking the trend and bringing the past to life for Philadelphia public school students.
Teachers who try to interest today's youngsters in American history must compete with the internet, instant messaging, and iPhones. Their biggest challenge may be elementary school students, who have been forced to focus on mathematics and reading by the No Child Left Behind Act. But on a recent afternoon at Clifton, the historic colonial mansion in Germantown, one class of fourth graders seems spellbound by the American Revolution.
Musketball. This would be shot out of a rifle. And you know what it does once it gets in your body? Did you ever see a pinball machine? It would go bump, 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 bump.
These students are participants in the History Hunters Youth Reporters Program, a joint venture of Germantown Historic Sites and the Philadelphia School District. Now in its sixth full year of operation, History Hunters has served more than 10,000 students in Mount Airy and Germantown. Stephen Haig, one of the developers of History Hunters, explains that the program grew out of the dual need to connect local students with history and to connect local historic sites with the reality of Germantown today.
And the question that we ask ourselves a lot is, how do these houses, which were primarily the homes of dead, rich, white, European males, how can they speak to everybody?
In 2001, four Germantown sites joined forces to develop a program which would teach students about their heritage in a lively, hands-on format. In Haig's eyes, these four locations represent nearly 200 years of American history.
Stenton, which is an early 18th century house that belonged to the secretary to William Penn, founder of the colony. Clifton, the site of the Battle of Germantown, major role in the American War for Independence. Wick, a historic house that documents Quaker life and farm life during the early 19th century. And the Johnson House, which is a place with a dazzling story about the Underground Railroad.
Working with consultants and the Philadelphia School District, employees of the four sites developed a year-long program for fourth and fifth graders who travel through American history by visiting each of the sites at roughly two-month intervals. Haig describes what students encounter at their first stop, Stenton, where James Logan negotiated treaties with Native Americans on the front lawn.
We have a role-playing activity where a class would be divided into groups where half acting as sort of colonial settlers, half acting as Native Americans, engaging in a role-playing exercise that deals with things like early cross-cultural contact, different language barriers, and how those can be addressed or overcome.
The second site students visit is Clifton, where the Battle of Germantown was fought in October 1777. On a cold winter day at the Clifton Barn, History Hunters guides await students from the C.W. Henry School in Mount Airy. Winky Hurwitz, a retired Philadelphia teacher who now acts as a guide, describes the equipment of a revolutionary soldier which the students will study that day.
The shirt's their favorite. You put the shirt on a child and you explain to the child, this is your shirt, your PJs, and your underwear. And of course you get, ew.
A few minutes later, a school bus pulls up and 30 excited students pour out. They cluster around the tables, handling the different items, taking notes and trying not to shout out answers to the guide's questions.
Does anybody know from their History Hunter workbook what this is called?
Haversack.
Haversack, good for you. And you know what? In your haversack, you would have had all kinds of things that you would have been carrying with you. One of the things would have been a
cup.
One fourth grade student, Daniel Edwards, describes what he's gotten out of his visit.
We're learning about the soldiers in the war. They didn't have a lot of money because England has their money when they had to pay taxes and all that stuff.
How do you like this program so far?
It's really cool. I like it. I get to learn about the stuff that happened where I live.
The History Hunters Youth Reporters Program has won numerous state and national awards, including a $300,000 We the People grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities. This 3-to-1 challenge grant, which History Hunters is 75% of the way toward matching, will provide the program with a $1 million endowment. This will ensure that for many years to come, fresh crops of youth reporters will explore Germantown, hunting down the secrets of Philadelphia history.
WRTI's Tom Keels. And that's it for now. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at WRTI.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony and C under Ross and Milnoff. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.